Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees. So our broadcast will look a little different today. And in the near future, as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington, we appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. Today we explore the state of human rights on the continent during the coronavirus pandemic. The use of security forces to enforce quarantines in order to prevent the spread of coronavirus is causing anxiety among some in African countries who fear conflict. VOA's Salim Solomon has the details.
Not long ago, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa ordered the deployment of 73,000 soldiers to enforce a lockdown in the country's fight against the coronavirus. The move is unprecedented in the modern history of the country.
Your mission is mission save lives. You are required to go out and save the lives of the 57 million South Africans who live within the borders of our country.
Across Africa, security forces are being called upon to seal borders, enforce quarantines, and maintain order. The measures are viewed with mixed emotions on a continent where, throughout history, military and police forces have been used to control the civilian population instead of protect them. There have already been instances of violence. Within the past 30 days, soldiers from the South African National Defense Force were accused of beating a man to death in Alexandra, north of Johannesburg. He was the ninth person killed in April by South African security forces, according to local reports. In Rwanda, police shot and killed two people while on patrol, enforcing a lockdown. In Kenya, police raided a shanty town in Nairobi and killed a 13-year-old. In Nigeria, the National Human Rights Commission reported that security forces killed 18 people in 2 weeks while enforcing restrictions on movement. John Siko, a director at a security consultant firm based in Dubai, said most militaries on the African continent are not trained in maintaining public order. Infantry training that teaches soldiers to subdue an enemy or retake a position could have tragic consequences when applied to a civilian population.
How many places are even sending guys into squatter camps or other informal settlements around the continent, potentially with live rounds? It doesn't take much to set off a real disaster here.
Siko said security forces need more training for missions that may require crowd control or other duties. Some militaries within the continent and with extensive peacekeeping experience create mock villages with paid actors to test the restraint of soldiers before they are deployed.
I think it just speaks to the need that across the continent there's a great deal of desire and necessity for public order training to make sure that guys can respond in a human rights respective manner when this does happen.
Dr. Cyrus Shapar agrees. He's a physician and director of the Prevent Epidemics team at a global public health organization with operations in Africa. He said the military has certain capabilities that could be useful when deployed in coordination with public health and medical systems.
Most militaries, when they get involved in disasters, do things like natural disasters. They're not so well trained on, say, infectious disease events, because these can actually affect the people responding as well. So it's important that training is in place if the military is going to get involved to protect the military too, that they understand the risks of them getting involved in an infectious disease event. And that's all based in science.
Siko said that foreign training often focuses on the military, but assistance is also needed to help the gendarmes and police forces most often called upon to interact with civilians.
I think the next few weeks are going to be quite critical. And again, unfortunately, I do think it's a bit too late for Western or donor responses to have much impact here. But again, it has to be strategic. Longer term, this is something that I think Washington, the administration and others need to really be considering moving forward.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Salem, for that report. joining us today to talk about how the coronavirus pandemic affects human rights in Africa. He is Professor Yetunde Odubasen Omede, visiting professor of politics and history at Farmingdale State College in New York, and Jean-Paul Ruhosha, Executive Director of Congo Today. Well, I have to say, Yetunde and Jean-Paul, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have another opportunity to host the two of you on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome. So talk to me about what is your reaction so far about how these security forces are enforcing or seem to be enforcing the lockdowns in various African countries?
Let me start with the Congo. Thank you again, Shaka, for the time and the question. It's really not good the way it's working in Congo, Congo-Kinshasa. In Kinshasa itself, the people who have been locked down, they don't have food. As you know, there is a poor people, a lot of poor people there. They don't have means like the way people do here or some other countries. So it makes so difficult for the people to be locked in the house without food when they work daily to make something for them to eat. So it's almost impossible for them to keep the way this guidance is, to social distancing and not to go to work and all those kind of things. That's one part of economy. And the second one is security. There is a big issue in Kinshasa. There is a division, high division in the high commander people. The president's office, chief of staff, Vitaly Kamerhe, he's in jail, among with 20 other people. Due to corruption, due to mangle of this kind of money that are supposed to help people from this pandemic.
I'm afraid, Jean-Paul, we'll talk about some of those details much later in the program. Yes. What about you, Yetunde?
Yes. I also think from a global perspective, the first reaction is a varied one. We see that governments have taken from moderate to extreme measures in order to control the pandemic, the outbreak of the pandemic. There are different countries who have had exposure to this pandemic at different numbers and different levels. So therefore, we're going to see, we have seen a varied response in terms of how they are handling their lockdown procedures. What are they doing to ensure that their citizens are safe during the period of their lockdowns? So you're going to see a different measures that are taken because, let's say, from Nigeria to South Africa, the numbers are not the same, right? And if we look at it from a global perspective, Italy and the United States, okay, these are countries that have examples of severe numbers of people who are succumbing to COVID-19. And so with the continent of Africa, we have to take it from a different approach when assessing the procedures that they're using, because again, there are different numbers of fatalities, different numbers of people who have gotten COVID-19, and I think which is also prompting the governments to take a different approach and response to combating COVID-19.
What about the different political systems that obtain on the continent? You have situations, for example, where some countries are democratic.
Yes.
You have other situations where some other countries are beginning or are in the process of being slightly more open in as far as the civil liberties of their people are concerned. But you also do have a lot of other countries on the continent, clearly, which are under autocratic rule. Are you seeing anything different? Some of the behavior, when you look at some of the security forces' behavior, to what extent do they reflect that type of political maturity?
Well, the interesting thing is that regardless of the different forms of government that are on ground, one thing that I see that is actually common in all forms of government during a state of emergency is that governments oftentimes put limitations on human rights. They oftentimes enforce statutes, right? Regardless if they're democratic or autocratic. They oftentimes enforce statutes that, again, hampen on the civil liberties of individuals. So I can see that commonality where we have a democratic country, even here in the United States during 9/11, when we talked about a state of emergency for the war on terror. The Congress used that opportunity to pass what we call the authorization for the use of military force, right? And that has been what we call a forever war. And so my concern is that no matter the government, are we going to have a forever pandemic response, meaning that the limitations that we have put on civil liberties and human rights, will that continue even after the pandemic? And I think that's the real question that is of concern right now.
To what extent would that be justified under what they characterize as issues of vital national security interest?
National security interest has always been a justification on the restraint of human rights and the limitation on civil liberties. So for any government, you can always say that we're in a state of an emergency. The national security of our citizens are most important. So therefore, we have to take certain measures to protect the country. And that has been a justification historically throughout. So if you need a justification, the pandemic is also a justification because it coincides with the national security protection of a country.
Now, Jean-Paul, you did have a crisis of Ebola, which lasted for a very long time. When you look at the behavior of the security forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo during this period of the coronavirus pandemic, to what extent would you compare their behavior with the times when you did have the Ebola crisis?
Well, I think on Ebola crisis, the whole entire world was watching, and it was a specific one area. It didn't go in the whole entire country. It was just in eastern Congo. So it was managed well. And the behavior, the way they approach it, and the way the country was due to security thing, it was managed well. Right now, it's in the whole entire country. And this is the world issue. This is a world war. It's everywhere. Now, it's a big issue that they are not able right now to manage it. As an example, simple example, the administration cannot even handle that because due to even the material to use, those ventilators that the people use to help people, they don't have that in the hospitals. And I just explained how the management was and the force that they were using the force in on the street to prevent people to go. It's a big issue in Kinshasa, especially in Kinshasa, where we have 17 million people. It's a very different the way they're managing it. This one, it's worse than the Ebola.
Now, Jean-Paul, when you think about a government, in a situation that obtains in your country, and indeed globally, wouldn't you expect to see the role of the government doing what it is expected to do, which is provide security, first and foremost, to its citizens?
Well, that's what we expect for the government to do. And unfortunately, it's not happening that way. As I just mentioned, there is an issue of mismanagement with this new administration. There is an issue of corruption. There is an issue of multiple groups of army that are in eastern Congo. Those cause the issue of not being able to manage those things. And also it causes not to have security. When the people don't have security, it's not easy for them to social distancing and also helping themselves to prevent from this COVID, and which is the big issue that we are having right now.
Now, Yetunde, it seems to me that part of the mother of the problem when it comes to Africa and the manner in which some of those countries are fighting the coronavirus pandemic is about the issue of social distancing.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that important issue, especially as reflected in African culture. When you talk about African culture, mm-hmm. you are really talking about a society or societies that reflect what is considered to be extended relationships.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about societies whereby where for economic, social, political situations, people in fact tend to live together.
Mm-hmm.
You find some 6 or 7 members of the family actually sharing a room.
Yeah.
People eat together.
Yeah.
People drink together.
Mm-hmm.
People almost inevitably share clothes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with this issue of social distancing, which is very paramount?
Mm-hmm.
Because in the absence, frankly, of a cure, in the absence of a vaccine,
mm-hmm.
in the absence of an effective therapy,
mm-hmm.
you definitely need social distancing.
Absolutely. And one of the things about African culture is that it's also transported to other parts of the world. So even though on a continent we have people who, of course, live together, they eat together, but there are certain proactive measures that the government can take. Look, the government has been receiving money from individual donors, from corporations, from millions to billions of dollars. Simple things of making sure that communities have gloves, communities have face masks in lieu of social distancing. If we know that these individuals have to live with one another, they have to, you know, be in the same room with one another, giving them gloves, helping them with hand sanitizers, giving them face masks. These are proactive measures that the government can do and use the money that has been given to them. To me, those are things that are what we call common sense human security. Because we talk a lot about security, but we have to understand that a government is responsible to provide an environment that is not harmful to the health and the well-being of their citizens. So how do we achieve that? We achieve that by understanding the culture that is at play, that what is underground, there are things, of course, that we cannot mitigate. So in lieu of understanding the culture and how people are always going to be around each other or live on top of each other, let's at least provide them with hand sanitizers. Let's at least provide them with gloves. Let's at least provide them with face masks. So when they are together, at least we have taken some preventative measures to at least lessen the spread of the virus. I think those are just simple ways for us to get ahead of what we already know is going to happen on ground. A lot of people are not going to follow social distancing rules. We have seen that where people are still oftentimes attending celebrations, they're attending funerals. So those are ways to say, look, if you're going to be outside, if you're going to go into a store, wear your face mask. This is the face mask that has been distributed by your local government, right? With federal allotment monies from the government. So, and I don't see that actually happening. And that is actually unfortunate because this is about human security. And if you're going to provide human security, you need to provide the means and the measures to ensure that everyone is safe.
Now, Jean-Paul, when you talk about social distancing, and in fact, you talk about lockout, when you look at the steps that governments in the Western world have actually taken, they have accompanied it with what they characterize as economic stimulus, a sort of economic lifeline. To what extent are governments on the continent providing the necessary accompanying economic stimulus, economic lifeline for their people in order for them to stay inside their houses? Because if they stay inside their houses without a sort of economic stimulus, it seems to me they may end up in fact fighting another potent virus. And that is starvation.
Yeah, which is what I just mentioned in a few minutes. It's a very hard for African in the continent, especially in Africa, to deal with this because of the issue of income. You just mentioned it very correctly and very good. It's almost impossible for somebody who doesn't have any saving account, who doesn't have a food stamp, who doesn't have any government assistance, who doesn't have anything to tell them not to go look for the food every day. And the government is not providing anything. And because of that, the people are very suffering, and we are going to see this spreading more. And that's why you see all these people who are specialists in this, they are saying when it comes to Africa, it will hit it very, very bad because of that issue. The people are not able to stay like you and I, we are doing here. They are not able to stay home. They are not able to protect themselves. They are not going to have $1,200 for them to eat for 2 weeks or 3 weeks to social distancing. And that's the issue. And that's why we need to work really hard to see how could Africa do that? How can they be able to prevent themselves? Not only for the security issue, but also economically. It's almost impossible for the African countries to be able to prevent in this. And it's going to end up going again in the whole entire world. When you look at it, it happened in China. It started in China. Then at the end of the day, it was everywhere in the world. And if we don't take it very serious in Africa, it will come back to Western countries too. So this is for everybody, we need to fight it in a correct way. And the African countries are not able to fight it with the means they have right now.
Now, Jean Paul, you know as well as I do that there is a saying that to whom much is given, more is expected. And as a matter of fact, I would tweak it and say, not only is more expected, but in fact, more and much should be shared. To what extent are you seeing the efforts of some of those people who are lucky enough to have unfettered access to resources, trying to figure out a way of reaching out to their neighbors to sort of play a role of being their neighbor's keeper?
The big issue here, Shaka, as I just said, it will be, as you know, the way they don't give the hands that gives, you need to receive. That's the way it is. So it's almost not easy for them to give without receiving. But again, we have to find that way. We have to have a strategy that will help to prevent. This is a common enemy. This is a common enemy. This coronavirus, it kills everybody. It doesn't have division. It doesn't have a continent. It doesn't have a color. As long as you're a human being, it will hit you. That's why we need to fight together, to be together, without looking for the returns, what we're going to return. Remember, what you're going to return is to prevent yourself. Preventing those who don't have anything to prevent themselves, it's preventing actually yourself. That's the response to your question. So that's exactly what we need to look at it. Those who have means to look, how could we use our means to prevent this to go to other people? Because, listen, they're going to travel. They're going to do this and that. And then we'll come back to you. So that's why we need to really engage, not thinking the return, not thinking that if I give you 1 million, you will give me a whole entire world. No, we need to think about preventing that. How could we preventing that completely to go spread to the human being? As long as it's spreading, it's going to come to you. Either you are rich, either you are poor, as long as you are a human being. So that's where the people should understand, not use it politically, actually use it as a human to prevent what can kill people. And it's been killing people. Here in the United States, we are the richest country, right? But we have 71,000. Mm-hmm. So does it show that, okay, we are just poor? No. It takes you, when it takes you, it will kill you. Either you have billions of dollars, either you are poor. So it's a really interest of everybody to take care of it, to resolve it in this kind of way, economically and the security way. Coming back for what the doctor just said, just 1 second. She said that we needed to provide, that the government need to provide the social distancing, the mask, and all the guidance that the government has been saying, or these medical people. But in Africa, it's almost impossible. Let me give you a simple example. In South Kivu, 10 households are going to gather in one house because of insecurity that's happening there. So how those people are going to do social distancing? Because they cannot go to the other land because there is enemies who's going to kill them. So that's my point. That's where I come from, saying, okay, we really need to take this serious to see how could we resolve, one, economic issue to everybody, and the security issue? If not, it's going to come to everybody.
What about you, Professor Yetunde? How do you react to that?
No, I understand his point, and that's why I said social distancing is very hard to enforce, which is why they're taking strict security measures to enforce social distancing by placing a lockdown and also making sure that people can either come out and not leave their houses from a certain time frame. When you have 10 people in a house, if one of them has the virus, that means the other 9 will get the virus. But if they are all wearing masks, at least it will limit the exposure to others who may have a strong immune system and may not get that virus. Some may be asymptomatic. So there are health reasons as to why globally people are saying, look, if you can't social distance, at least wear a mask, at least wash your hands, at least wear gloves. These are actual preventative measures that are taking place all over the world. I can't go into a store in Long Island, New York, without wearing a mask. You understand? So there are measures in place. But the real question here is, can Africa afford this lockdown and pandemic with 1.3 billion people? Can we test everybody? Does the country have the magnitude and the capacity, money to do this? I continuously read reports about countries borrowing money from the IMF in order to combat this pandemic. Again, we are now putting ourselves deeper into debt. We are now putting ourselves deeper into relations with the IMF, who, in a sense, of course, historically has had their entanglements and embattlements with African countries. But this has been a rude awakening. I wrote an article for The Guardian. It's called COVID's Rude Awakening. And I think what is the rude awakening is the fact that the money that should have been used to put into the healthcare system wasn't done over the years. We have dilapidated healthcare systems that would have been what we call our saving grace on the African continent. Money that could have been put into progressive technology in terms of testing, airports that could have had also progressive technology to ensure that when people are coming, you can test them. I mean, these are things that, look, you don't wait for a bomb to strike before you build up your defense, before you build up your military. You take active measures to ensure that you have a strong military. So if anything happens, you're prepared. Unfortunately, the pandemic took everyone by surprise. But most importantly, countries were not prepared. There are some countries, of course, who were able to dig into their federal coffers, provide that money to all the different states to ensure that they are taking care of their citizens. And there are just some countries who have mismanaged funds to the point where everyone is just trying to protect themselves. And like I said, when it comes to one of the major priorities of a government, it is to ensure the security of its citizens. And it's not only military security. Military has nothing to do with this. Bombs and AK-47s are not going to help us. What we're talking about is our intellectual capacity and human security. Hospitals are human security. Well-qualified doctors are human security. And unfortunately, we did not invest our time and our money into these things, and we are in a serious situation right now.
Time is not our best ally. We have to go for a break. So please, don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. Every week, connect with our experts. You can ask them your questions and get their advice. Join me, Lino Mudu, in Washington on Healthy Living, your new health program, right here on Voice of America.
Yetunde, what is interesting is that when you look at Forbes magazine, an American magazine which sometimes identifies some of the richest men and women in the world, or in different countries around the globe, you will find that whereas in North America, in Europe, and in Asia for that matter, you do have significant individuals with significant wealth.
Absolutely.
But when it comes to the African continent, apart from people like Aliko Dangote of Nigeria, apart from people like Tony Elmer, and what have you, most of the riches are in the hands of the same people who control the politics, the same people and their families.
Yeah.
To what extent would those individuals at the political helm of their countries and their families, to what extent should they now step up to the plate and make sure that they contribute to the needs of their less fortunate people on the continent?
So in Nigeria, we have had surprisingly a large number of wealthy individuals from the Adenugas to the Dangotes to the Elemule donating money, okay, to the federal government, donating money to initiatives that have to combat the COVID-19. So this is going on billions of naira. Now, the interesting thing is that, look, when the Nigerian government locked down the airport, they all realized that I can't escape and leave to get healthcare in another country, like many of these elite, you know, people in society usually do. They usually travel out to go to London or the UK or the United States to go and receive medical treatment, including many of them in the federal government. Unfortunately, in this pandemic, when all airports were shut down and all planes were grounded, we were literally left to ourselves and left to face the fact that if anything happened to me, can I rely on my healthcare system? And I believe that also was an impetus to a lot of the billionaires that said, you know what? I need to take my money and put it where it matters. Because if anything happens to me or my family or my colleague, what are we going to do? And I think that's why I said this pandemic is a rude awakening. Because when you are in a country that you have neglected for a long period of time and you have looked to other places to receive what your country should be able to provide to you, you now realize the greatest disservice that you're doing. Look, when billionaires, they make their money, right? They are at no what we call obligation to give all their money away, right? Maybe there's a moral obligation and of course by taxes, but the moral obligation is what we're looking at. You're a billionaire. Your money can build hospitals. Your money can build educational institutions. Why not put that so the country can be progressive and help the country out? These are moral obligations. And I think now, hopefully, and unfortunately, it probably took this pandemic for many of our wealthy political elite to really understand that we have actually did a disservice to the rest of the population because we're no different than them. If I get the virus like someone who has no money, we both end up in the same grave, not able to take anything with us. We both are equal in that sense. And I think that's an important thing for everyone to have that reckoning with.
Now, talking about politics, when you look at the circumstances, any particular reason, for example, why leaders on the African continent really should not put the politics aside and do the right thing? You have reports, for example, in certain African countries where the government in power is trying to dominate the political space to such an extent that it is in fact putting roadblocks in front of political members of the opposition to do what they want to do in terms of making contributions to the lesser fortunate members of their society.
Well, I mean, it's politics. And unfortunately, politicians will always use opportunities to further their own agenda, even in a national, even in a global pandemic or state of emergency. This has always been done. This is one of the things they do to further their agenda, to secure their future votes. And unfortunately, in times like this, where politics should be put to the side, and humanitarian assistance and making sure the citizens are okay should be the number one priority. There are politicians and they are those who are in leadership positions who do not know how to put that to the side. Everything is always to further the agenda. Everything is always to win votes. Everything is always to secure power. And that's the unfortunate other side of politics.
Jean-Paul, we talk about citizens. As a matter of fact, Professor Etunde just mentioned citizens. citizenship. Mm-hmm. And yet, the reality is that in Africa, apart from a few countries really, mm-hmm. most people are subjects, or at least they are treated as subjects in the sense that they do not in fact have claim to what you would call constitutional rights, or inalienable rights, or birthrights for that matter. Mm-hmm. They have rulers who are not leaders, who do not conduct business in a manner that puts them in a situation where they have to embrace the concept of accountability. Mm. Because who do they account to? In order for you to account for somebody, you have to have a citizen. Mm-hmm. This citizen has to owe allegiance to the state or to the government in order to have constitutional rights and in order to be part of essentially what you would call a group of people really that are the bosses, the main stakeholders. But in this particular case, you have people on paper who seem to be citizens, but in reality, they in fact owe allegiance to an individual authority who could be a presidential monarch, who could be a monarch, or who could be an autocrat. And therefore, they do not really expect constitutional rights, but rather they expect some privileges handed to them from these individual authorities. How do we get away from this syndrome? Or rather, in fact, appropriately, how do we begin talking about a situation where you have African citizens who demand their constitutional rights to be asserted?
I think that's a democracy. That's the definition of a democracy we need. We need a democracy. We need the people to have a say in everything. We need the government, the people, the leaders, to understand that. I think this coronavirus, it comes to teach us how, let me go back on what the doctor just said, and I will come back to the question. If you look at it, the way people used to spend their money, going to get a treatment in the USA, in the Europe, in the UK, everywhere. And right now, there is no one who's going to fly in the United States because the United States is not able to even handle what's going on here. UK, Europe, everywhere. So which comes back to you saying, okay, I think I needed to provide and to develop a strategy to build what I was going to look in Europe to do it here. And that will bring us back to say, okay, then if we can do that, we can. I thank you to mention what's happening in Nigeria. The whole African should do that, should contribute to build their own system, their own health system, their own security, their own economy. That's how we're going to get people to have rights. That's how we're going to get people to understand. That's how we're going to have that freedom to speak and to respect what we need to respect. Also, I mentioned about the corruption thing. There is nobody who's going to take them accountable if we don't exercise democracy and the respect of the law and the respect of the constitution that we put together. If we don't do that, we are not going to be able to develop as it should. We are going to continue to be lured and to beg for the aids, to beg for this and that, when we have all the resources and the knowledge to develop ourselves. I think we really needed to put on a side this kind of mentality of thinking that everything has to be on the Western side. No, we have to understand that we are able to do this. We can handle this. We are smart. We can be rich. We can provide our own security. We can live together. We can stop this division. And then understanding exactly what means to respect a human right. If we understand that, everybody will have a say. Everybody will have a freedom. And that's the way that we're gonna build Africa. And that's the way we're going to have the solution to this problem we have. the crisis we are having, we are facing now, the economic crisis we've been facing for decades, the insecurity issue that we've been facing for this long time, we will resolve by understanding what matters the most. What matters the most to live together, it's working together, it's having the right for everybody. And we have seen the consequence of it, where we everybody has to face this coronavirus as a common enemy. This has to teach all African and the whole entire world to see that everybody can count to each other.
You know, it is very interesting because when you look at the crisis globally and you look at Africa, you start talking about how Africa lacks resources. On the contrary, Africa does not lack resources.
Yeah.
I think what it lacks really is first and foremost the leadership, frankly, that is required at this point in time.
Exactly.
And somebody, frankly, that has the interests of their people at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody that has the political will to do things that reflect the interests of the vast majority of the African continent.
Yeah.
I have a story that I came across in the 1970s when I was an undergraduate student in New York.
Mm.
It was a former president of what was called Zaire. Now, of course, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That president was Marshal Mobutu Sese Seko Wazabanga.
Kukumengo Wazabanga.
He's reported to have come here in the 1970s during the Carter administration and was seeking for a very fat loan. And the intelligence information on him had suggested that, in fact, he was one of the richest individuals on this planet Earth. And because of that information, President Carter reportedly asked Mobutu why he couldn't be kind enough to lend his government some of his money on his bank account. It is reported that Mobutu looked at him and said that government would probably be not in a position to pay back that money.
Oh.
Can you imagine?
Yes, that's a big problem. That's a big problem. In Africa, we that's a two issues that we have. One, we have very rich individuals,
mm-hmm.
and very powerful people, individuals also. When we shouldn't have that kind of thing, we should have a powerful institution that provides everything that people need. We should have a richest government that will provide for the people, not individual having that kind of resources and money to put the money himself. If you take a look and see, okay, what Mobutu has, was it from the business he did, from heritage family? No. If you take a look, you will find that that's a man of the people that he took and put in his own account, which brings me back to the example that I just gave to you. Right now, Chief of Staff of President Felix Tshisekedi, he's in jail, Vitali Kamerhe, due to corruption. What do you think corruption is? He took money from the account of the government, the central bank, to his account. More than 20 people in cabinet of president are in jail due to that. And the investigation is still going on.
And about how much money are we talking about here?
370 million, Shaka.
What?
370 million.
You can't.
That's the money we are talking. Yeah. And how long that takes? In 1 year that they've been in the cabinet. They haven't been there for a long time, but we are talking about 370 million. You will see they will appear in the court on 11th of this next week, I believe.
Very interesting.
And that's the issue. And that's what African countries need to tackle, need to look at. When you have the kind of such leaders, they don't think, even think about the people. They won't think about the hospital. They won't think about security.
Do you sincerely refer to those individuals as leaders?
No. These are just mafia people. I don't refer as leaders, because you cannot be a leader and be corrupt on that level. You cannot be a leader. In 1 year, the people are suffering. We have a country with 100 Tory armed groups from all over the Africa. And you are busy just stealing money from your own people instead of tackling the issue of insecurity, instead of going to see what's going on with this biggest enemy we have, which is the coronavirus, to tackle those kind of issues. You are busy stealing the money from the people. And those are the readers. Those are just the mafia's people.
So well, also, Professor, I'm not sure you are aware that on Monday, May 4th, $311 million, which was stolen from the citizens of Nigeria during the Abacha regime, was returned safely back to the country from the United States and the Bailiwick of Jersey. $311 million on May 4th, dollars were returned back to the government of Nigeria to help with infrastructure projects from the United States and from the Bailiwick of Jersey. Meaning that, a dictator from Abacha's regime can still have money. And of course, it is reported of how much he had looted, up to billions and billions of even dollars. That in this present time in a pandemic, that money will be turned back. The issue that we always have with African countries is transparency. We borrow money with our left hand, but we have money in our right hand. Economically, it just doesn't make sense sometimes. $311 million, do you know what that can do, even for the country for itself? How that can help its citizens? Why take money from the IMF if you have this money that has been returned to you on Monday, May 4th? You have billions of Naira that have been also donated from corporations and wealthy individuals. So the question is, where is the money? What are you doing with the money? Who's managing the money and where is it going? This is information that the citizens are privy to. These are information that is in the public. So once you have that information, you also have the duty and the obligation to continue providing us with transparency and information that allows us to understand where the money is going.
You're talking about the need for accountability.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Now, Professor Yetunde, there are times when I speak with my friends in Africa, mm-hmm. and they laugh at me and say, but you, Shaka, you're experiencing the same problems in the United States. And I tell them how. Well, we see the behavior of some of your leaders, that behavior doesn't seem to be significantly different from our leaders.
Yeah.
But I respond to them by saying that you are talking about two different societies, really.
Yeah.
One society, where I live here in the United States of America, you're talking about a society of laws.
Mm-hmm. Rules and regulations.
A society that is run by strong institutions.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I tell them that even if you are a president living on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue,
mm-hmm.
in order for you to make sure that you get what you want to navigate your way by negotiating around those strong institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most of Africa, you are talking about a society of men,
yeah,
a society of women.
Mm-hmm.
As a political scientist, Yetunde, can you walk us through the difference between those two sets of societies?
All right, so when we talk about those two sets of societies, each country has their own constitution. Now, the thing about countries is that how important that constitution governs the country. In the United States, you also have to look at the different levels of corruption globally, right? One thing, yes, the United States has corruption. There is no country that is devoid of corruption. But the thing about it is that it's still a functioning government. I can still pick up the phone and call 911 and the ambulance arrive at my house. I can still drive down the street and the roads are paved. I can still, you know, call a police officer if I need assistance. There are certain practices and measures that are in place, right, that are not in places in countries that experience high levels of corruption, that oftentimes conduct constitutional coups, who, depending on whoever is in office, therefore jeopardizing the legitimacy of the Constitution itself. These are practices that don't happen in other countries. So when we're comparing the two, we can say that Nigeria is a democracy, the United States is a democracy, but there's some measures that are in place that things that happen in Nigeria won't necessarily happen in the United States to a degree that it's happening in other African countries and within Nigeria. So like I said, it's the functioning of the government. Can a government function with high levels of corruption? That's the question.
What about the one great American president who presided this country during the Great Civil War, Abraham Lincoln?
Yeah.
He is quoted as having said that his definition of democracy would be a government of the people,
for the people. Yeah.
What about some observers who say that most of Africa really has governments which they characterize as a government of some people, by some people, and for some people?
Well, that is an interesting take, but what I do want to say that even here in the United States, even though we do say it's for the people, by the people, there are some still issues that we also deal with here, whether it be prejudice or racism or things that also affect, it's not a perfect country, no country is a utopia, but what we see mostly, especially in, I don't know if I call them fledgling or flourishing democracies, they're democracies on paper, but they're not really living out what we call democratic tenets, is that you have too many political elites who believe that they are there either by divine right, that they are there and they are superior to those who they are supposed to serve. So we have really what we call a majesty sort of subject relationship instead of an equal relationship. I am in this position because I was appointed, I was elected, I wasn't anointed in this position. So you have to understand there's a godlike persona that we also see in a lot of the leaders, the idea that citizens are there to obey me. They're there to serve me. No, they're there to obey the Constitution that has preceded you. They are there to obey the rules and the laws and the regulations. You as a president serve as a representation, an embodiment of that. You as an individual are not the Constitution, right? You are to be the representative. And I think there's always a mix up in that, in the way that the leaders see themselves. So it's a psychological thing. It's a personality cult that we see. It's a personality rule in a sense. I am powerful. I am majestic. I've been in this position because I am great. I've been appointed by divine right. It's almost like their kingdom, like their God, the godlike sort of persona. And when you have a godlike persona, nobody can tell you different. Nobody can tell you wrong. Nobody can correct you. No one can hold you accountable. You are accountable to no one. So that is a lot of the issues that we see just in terms of the leaders that continue to be put in those situations. And also godfatherism. We have a lot of that on the African continent, where in order for you to be in politics or for you to be the head of state, someone has to come and say, okay, let me open the door for you. And the cycle continues, which is why we don't see a new generation of leadership in Africa. We see a recycled generation. And that is one of the major issues that we have.
You know, Jean-Paul, you touched a very interesting issue. You touched the issue of the lack of what I would call adequate healthcare infrastructure on the African continent. You talked about how, for example, some of the elite that routinely used to go abroad and the vaccines for very simple medical checkup.
Mm.
No longer can do that because most international airports are closed.
Mm.
Is it possible that this coronavirus pandemic may in fact have the effect of giving us a huge window of opportunity for some of these individuals to realize the need, the imperative need, to put in place such infrastructure, the type of infrastructure not only that are good for other people, but they are also good for them and their families.
Exactly. I think so. And the answer to that, yes, because now we are seeing that. We are seeing that we are not able, she just mentioned how the airport are closed. The airport are closed and everything is closed. We cannot go anywhere to get that kind of thing. This is the biggest opportunity to help us to think, okay, now we need to do this home. Now we need to work on our infrastructure. We need to develop a capacity of our people to be able to treat us. We need to get medical doctors. We need to do all this kind of stuff to put it together so that we can have that home. Whatever was going to look in the United States, I can look at it in my home country, in Congo, in Kabare, in Nigeria, everywhere in Africa. Not just thinking that you are going to do a medical checkup somewhere else. This is a good thing that it's showing us to understand that we need really to put our efforts together and our strength together to build our home countries where we can all run, where we can do benefit.
One of my colleagues here has suggested a very interesting idea, mm-hmm. and that is that could we please, and I'm saying this from the deepest data part of the bottom of my Calvary heart and soul, take at least 1 minute of silence in the honor of those who have suffered, who have lost their loved ones, who have lost their lives under the coronavirus pandemic globally and the mother continent of Africa. Well, on that note, our distinguished guests were Professor Yetunde Obubesan Omede, Department of Politics and History at Farmingdale College, Rhode Island, New York, Jean-Paul Ruhosha, the Executive Director of Congo Today. On that note, get better and not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive. Thank you.